Welcome to Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source, grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get some notebook, paper, and pen if you want to take some notes during the show. First, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. Elizabeth Warren's plan to prevent another financial meltdown, crowdsourcing, from the Daily Caller by Amanda Carey. Elizabeth Warren, America's working-class warrior, who Time magazine dubbed Sheriff of Wall Street, has revealed her strategy for preventing another catastrophic financial meltdown. The former Harvard law professor is going to put out an open call to working-class America for tips. When the financial collapse hit in 2008, America's best financial minds went to work trying to explain the cause of the meltdown, which later turned into a recession. Banks became the number one target, as everyone from politicians to professors lambasted practices like predatory lending, providing low interest rates, and doling out subprime mortgages. Enter Warren with her novel solution of how to prevent another financial disaster. After months of speculation over what role President Obama would be brave enough to give Warren, the polarizing architect of the new Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, BCFP, she was finally appointed assistant to the president and special advisor to the Secretary of Treasury in September. Not quite the title some said she deserved, it still amounted to a de facto position as head of the BCFP. After breaking her near moratorium on media interviews, Warren talked exclusively with the National Journal, where she explained her plan to use crowdsourcing technology as a platform for collecting complaints and getting suggestions from consumers about how to best protect them against banks. It's about how we receive information about how the world works, Warren said in the interview. It's about how people will tell us about what is happening. I want you to think about this more like heat maps for targeted zip codes where problems are emerging or among certain demographic groups or among certain issuers. The relatively new idea, the concept of crowdsourcing, first appeared in a 2006 piece in Wired magazine involving gathering information from masses of people rather than specialized individuals. Think Wikipedia, for example. The power to harness information from crowds exceeds the power and capability of a few smart minds, or so the theory goes. Warren has high hopes for the unorthodox approach, which, until now, was largely left to the business and tech worlds. Her hopes are so high, in fact, that Warren believes outsourcing will change the way the economy works. The power of enforcement will be partly about the agency, but it will be partly in the future about how people crowdsource around identified problems, Warren said. The idea that people can talk to each other, whether it's through the agency or from other platforms, is what crowdsourcing is. She continued, in a sense, the whole notion of how markets work will change. Not everyone agrees. Peter Wallison, senior fellow in financial studies at the American Enterprise Institute, thinks crowdsourcing will actually create more problems than it fixes. There is a trade-off between the number of people assigned to investigation and the number of people assigned to receiving complaints, Wallison told the Daily Caller. If most of your personnel have to be assigned to receiving and assessing complaints because these are pouring in, then you have fewer to investigate the legitimate ones. In other words, crowdsourcing is more likely to have the BCFP's operations less efficient, according to Wallison. Not only that, Wallison thinks Warren's hope of achieving collective consensus on how to arm consumers with the necessary knowledge needed to wage battle against Wall Street bankers could prove to be overly optimistic. As Wallison notes, Warren's technique would only make it easier for consumers to deluge the BCFP with complaints that could drown an agency in individual disputes, reducing its effectiveness in addressing the serious ones. Warren is currently charged with hiring roughly 1,000 new workers to staff the BCFP before it becomes fully operational in July 2011. Moving on to a related article in the National Journal, Warren outlined sweeping new approach to consumer financial protection, investigations through crowdsourcing, wikis, and heat mapping. This is by Bill Swindell. Elizabeth Warren, the architect of the new Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection, spelled out a sweeping new strategy to use the latest in crowdsourcing technology to collect tips from millions of consumers about deceptive new financial practices, from misleading mortgages and improper gotcha fees on credit cards to outright fraud. In an interview with the National Journal, Warren said new techniques like crowdsourcing, scaled-up variations of Wikipedia, make it possible to collect valuable information from millions of ordinary consumers who report problems as they arise. Using new systems to organize and find patterns in all the information, Warren said, the Bureau could be able to spot new enforcement targets in a matter of days, an unheard-of response time for traditional regulators. Crowdsourcing has become one of the hottest forms of information gathering and refers to online collaborations like Wikipedia that are built through contributions from thousands or even millions of people. It is an entirely new approach for government regulators, but Warren says she believes the opportunities are great. It's also about how we will receive information about how the world works, she said. It's about how people will tell us about what is happening. If you want to think about this more like heat maps for targeted zip codes where problems are emerging, or among certain demographic groups, or among certain issuers, that's the ticket, Warren said in her still not decorated office. Warren's outside-the-box thinking to consumer complaints comes as she ramps up the establishment of the agency for next July and hires about 1,000 workers. Consumer groups have been concerned that the new agency will have insufficient resources to handle consumer complaints, given the wide swath under its jurisdiction, from home mortgages to payday loans to credit reports. The Dodd-Frank Financial Regulatory Law requires the Bureau to develop a nationwide consumer complaint center, but Warren's ideas go beyond those traditionally embraced federal agencies. To help solicit answers, Warren will visit Silicon Valley, including a visit to Google. Under her vision, Warren imagines a subset of Americans reporting on a specific problem, such as extraneous fine print included in a bank's checking account statement, documenting it through use of a camera phone, and then emailing it to the Bureau within seconds. The Bureau would use such data to target its enforcement. In the old world, it would be up for the agency to come in, and you look very slowly through a sample of the banks to see what products they mailed out, and did they add a lot of fine print nonsense by regulation that was not supposed to be there, Warren said. Under her example, now all of a sudden, you've got information, and you've got it much faster, and you have it more pinpointed, and that becomes relevant for purposes of where you spend enforcement resources, she added. The strategy would also overhaul current regulatory enforcement by making it much nimbler, ready to immediately react to issues, rather than relying on examination and enforcement through a rote schedule. The change would have a major effect on banks and other covered institutions, forcing them to be more responsive to a regulator than they have been in the past, as well as on guard to handle any public relations fallout that could quickly spread through a crowdsourcing effort. The power of enforcement will be partly about the agency, but it will be partly in the future about how people crowdsource around identified problems, Warren said. The idea that people can talk to each other, whether it's through the agency or from other platforms, is the goal. In a sense, the whole notion of how markets work will change. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now I'd like to move on to the discussion we've been having on debt collection practices using articles from the Boston Globe, actually a series of articles known as Debtor's Hell, which has many issues about debt collection. In the last several weeks, we looked at Preying on Red Ink America, No Mercy for Consumers, and how strong-arming from debt collectors can be devastating for individuals in terms of property such as automobiles and homes. So we start with a story. The line for metal detector crept slowly at Brockton District Court on the morning of April 12th. Peter Damon waited anxiously. He didn't want to be late. Finally, he hoped to face down for good the debt collector who had been hounding him and his mother for more than 2 years over a $980 credit card bill. He'd had to miss his first scheduled meeting in small claims court a year earlier, and a note in his file explained why. Phone call from defendant. He is in the Walter Reed Army Medical Center in Washington, D.C., upon return from Iraq and losing both arms. A lot of things could have gone Damon's way in the wake of that phone call. None did. The clerk who took the call could have advised Damon that, under federal law, he could delay the case while he recovered. The court could have challenged the debt collector, Norfolk Financial Corporation, about the claim in its lawsuit that Damon was not a soldier, a claim made under penalties of perjury. And the clerk should have simply dismissed the case when Damon, having recovered sufficiently to take a $400 flight home from the hospital, arrived for a hearing in September, only to find the collection lawyer unprepared. But such simple justice was denied Damon, as it is thousands of other debtors when they come up against the lowest level of the state court system. And this is in Massachusetts, but much of it can apply anywhere in the United States. The People's Court has become the Collector's Court, according to the investigation by the Globe Spotlight team. It is a de facto arm of a fast-growing and aggressive industry that has swamped court dockets with lawsuits, cases that often lead to threats of jail for debtors. Created to provide a low-cost, level playing field for citizens with disputes of $2,000 or less, as an aside, it would be $5,000 in Iowa, the small claims courts have muted into a system that often ignores individual rights and shows favoritism toward collectors and their lawyers. On some days, indeed, collection lawyers appear to be in charge, with no oversight by judicial officials. Debtors often feel intimidated in this arena, and with reason. The system is tilted against them. And 150 years after the state of Massachusetts' last debtors' prisons were shuttered, some, even now, find themselves locked up for failing to pay. A Brockton man, for example, was imprisoned for 4 weeks over last Christmas. Now, more commonly, the threat of jail is a scare tactic, another way to force quick results in a rubber stamp kind of system, where the supreme priority in many courts is to move the flooding of collection cases along with little regard for the merits or the dignity of individual defendants. In this story, Peter Damon is one whose dignity took a considerable beating. As he reached the head of the security line that April day, Damon's new prosthetic arms, clearly visible in his Johnny Damon baseball shirt, set off the metal detector. By the time the 33-year-old veteran got to the hearing room, he was 2 minutes late. Tentatively, he approached the desk of the assistant clerk magistrate. "Yes," said the clerk, "William J. Martin III." Damon stammered out his name, at which Martin snapped, "This is not time for that." And then he scolded, "Have a seat. I don't know what possessed you to do that." Now, Damon ultimately won that day when Norfolk's lawyer suddenly offered to dismiss the case. "Martin obliged. Dismissed," he said, never glancing up from his desk. In his victory, Damon was one of the lucky ones. A Globe review of proceedings and records in 20 of the state's 70 small claims courts found that court officials and collection lawyers routinely break court rules, almost always to the detriment of the defendant. Collectors are almost never asked to prove the debts they claim, and that's an important point. Collectors are never asked to prove the debts they claim. Defendants are rarely informed of their rights, and debtors, usually too strapped to afford a lawyer, must contend with this legal mismatch alone. Russell Engler, a professor at the New England School of Law, who studies the way people are treated in civil court, said unrepresented parties often get steamrolled. While it can be tricky for clerk magistrates and judges when only one side has a lawyer, he said, those are precisely the cases in which court officials should act to redress the imbalance. "You have a system that is supposed to be accessible to ordinary people," Engler said. "Instead, it's operating as a swift tool for corporations with power and with lawyers." The Chief Justice of the District Court System, Linda M. Connolly, expressed surprise during an interview with the Globe at the extent to which corporate debt collectors have come to dominate small claims sessions. Some of the abuses described to her by the Globe were, she said later, horrific. Take another example. Diane Albertson's experience in court was nothing short of humiliating. A 50-year-old mother and nursing student, Albertson stood before Judge Thomas Barrett in Brockton District Court, called to account for a $438 oil bill that she believed mistakenly she had paid. She admits she had been sloppy about the matter, missing court dates twice in the crush of family and school obligations. After an initial court judgment against her, she sent a check to satisfy the debt, but stopped payment on it. That made the plaintiff, Stanley Litchfield of Scudder Fuel, angry, and understandably so. The firm had waited more than a year to be paid, but even he was shocked at what the judge did that day. "Take off your rings," Barrett said, according to the court's audio transcript of the hearing. "All of my jewelry?" Albert replied in dismay. "I can't give you my wedding ring." "Let me see it," Barrett said, ordering her to approach the bench and splay her hands before him. He then told her sternly to remove the other rings, including her diamond and amethyst engagement ring and her earrings. "Are you serious?" Albertson asked, near tears. "We'll hold them until the debt's paid," Barrett said. "Either that or I'll incarcerate you. Do you want me to incarcerate you?" Albertson handed over her jewelry, keeping only the thin gold band on her left ring finger. A bailiff sealed them in a plastic bag, where they would stay for a month. Engler, the law professor, called Barrett's behavior outrageous. "Litigants are supposed to be able to be heard and be treated with respect," Engler said. "The judge sets the tone for everything." Barrett declined to be interviewed. If you're just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Humiliations, large and small, are an everyday reality in many Massachusetts small claims courts. Often, debtors are treated with less courtesy than the accused felons in the criminal court across the hall, and their rights are really less respected. And here are some examples. In Quincy District Court, a clerk magistrate barks at defendants packed into a cramped room if they don't reply loudly enough to the call of their names. in New Bedford, collection lawyer Martin Ostrichel calls the names of an older woman who has been waiting in line for 2 hours. As she hobbled toward him, leaning on her cane, he admonishes, "Hurry up." In Worcester, more than 60 people summoned for civil debt collection cases sit in a large courtroom that says criminal over the door. The noise from the adjacent lockup is so loud it drowns out the magistrate as she calls out the list of lawsuits. Angrily, she shouts for quiet, not realizing the noise is coming from the prisoners. The cowed debtors on the benches before her are silent. And in Lowell District Court, on the Tuesday before Christmas, an assistant clerk magistrate calls debtors up to her desk, one by one, to review their promises to pay. She then warns everyone, if you don't pay, you could be found in contempt and you could go to jail. Connolly, the district court chief, said it's reasonable for court officials to inform debtors of the worst case scenario. But pressed as to whether the courts ought to issue jail threats, Connolly said, "Let's be very clear. It is not appropriate for anybody to threaten anybody in small claims or any place else. Yet such threats are a common tool, both in small claims court and in the district court civil sessions, which handle debt cases between $2,000 and $25,000. The article gives another example. Last year, Jack Frioli, the owner of a small struggling cleaning enterprise, was called before a judge in Dedham District Court after falling behind on payments he'd promised to make to a vendor. His $9,000 debt had ballooned to nearly $12,000 with interest and fees, which is not an unusual thing. It happens very, very quickly. Frioli's wife was ill, and the family's car had been towed 3 times by debt collectors. After being badgered in the court corridor by a collection lawyer, Hindle Grossman, he agreed to pay $250 a month, even though he knew that would be a stretch. In the courtroom, Judge Sarah B. Singer reviewed the agreement and warned Frioli of the serious import of his promise to pay. "It's not a promise to get this lady off your back," she said, referring to Grossman. "Pay the money or go to jail." She added, "That's a result no one in this room wants to see." In Massachusetts, judges regularly hear debt cases in civil court, but in 1993, the responsibility for small claims cases was turned over to clerk magistrates. Today, judges get involved in small claims mainly when people ignore judgments against them. That can make cases sent to judges more highly charged, observed Jason David Frago, a consumer lawyer in Longmeadow. Some judges, he said, tend to treat people who owe debts like criminals. The sheer volume of cases seems to encourage rough or dismissive treatment of defendants, the Globe found. There were nearly 122,000 small claims filed in 2005 in Massachusetts, marking an 11% rise over the past decade. Meanwhile, court budgets have been slashed and court staff reduced by 14% since 2000. Officials say there's barely time to get through the docket, much less attend to the considerations behind each claim. And this continues today. It is not unusual, given the extraordinary number of cases before district courts, that the urgent overwhelms the important, Connolly says. We can do better. Connolly, after the interview with the Globe, appointed a panel to review the small claims courts, convened a training session for clerks and judges, and is studying ways to make defendants more aware of their rights and to curb the influence of collection lawyers. One early change, court officials have been told to be sure debtors do not agree to make payments out of their government assistance checks. If we see areas that we can improve, then we will make those improvements, said Connolly, who became Chief Justice when the study was underway. I'm committed to doing that. Generally, courts don't track the number of cases filed by debt collectors, but the Globe, after hand-counting cases in the state's computer system, interviewing numerous clerks and judges, and attending dozens of hearings, determined that at least 60% of all cases funneled through the civil courts are brought by professional collectors. One credit card firm, Capital One Financial Corp., filed more than 38,000 small claims lawsuits against Massachusetts consumers in 4 years. At Boston Municipal Court, the state's busiest small claims court, roughly 85% of the lawsuits are brought by companies collecting old debts, according to Kevin L. Callahan, first assistant clerk magistrate for the Civil Division. The downtown court handled 40,000 small claims in 5 years. It gets so many suits from Norfolk Financial, Commonwealth Receivables, Filene's, and Enstar that it had ink stamps made for each one. And those are all debt collection agencies. At the cost of just $40 to file a lawsuit for any amount up to $2,000, debt collectors find a bargain in Massachusetts small claims. A victory in court lets them pursue a debt for up to 20 years, and that's the same as Iowa, and earn 12% annual interest on it, a rate that's matched or exceeded in only 5 states. The legislature hasn't adjusted that rate since the 1980s. We're sophisticated collection agencies for these people, Callahan said. This is a lucrative business for some. I hate it. It isn't just the indulgence of court officials that makes winning these cases so easy for debt collectors. The defendants also do their part. About 80% of people sued for debts in Massachusetts courts fail to show up at all, according to the estimates of clerks and lawyers and the Globe's observation. There are many reasons for that. Some people ignore letters from collectors in the court, the sort of carelessness that got them in trouble in the first place. Others know they owe money, but can't easily get time off work. Still others never receive a notice of the court date. In Massachusetts, notices of lawsuits are sent by first-class mail to the address supplied by collectors. Often these addresses are out of date, yet the courts assume the defendant was notified unless the letter is returned. This is a flawed system, the Globe found in a test of 100 letters sent to the same person at incorrect addresses across the state. Just 52 came back marked "Return to Sender" by the post office. The other 48 simply went missing. A backup requirement that debtors receive notice by certified mail was dropped several years ago as a cost-saving measure. Even when properly delivered, the notice sent to defendants would confuse almost anyone. The debtor's instructions are listed in tiny, faint type on the back of the form and are in many ways misleading. For example, they say the plaintiffs must prove their claims, something that never occurred during the many hearings attended by the Globe. They also fail to warn defendants of the serious consequences of failing to appear. The collector automatically wins, gaining the right to seize property, garnish wages, put a lien on a home, or get a civil arrest warrant to have the defendant hauled into court. Even defendants who do show up tend to lose most of the time, and for a simple reason. They owe the money, or at least part of it. But many cases that could be contested are not. With a little information and pluck, lawyers say, many defendants could turn the tables against the collectors by demanding that they produce evidence of the debt. You have rights, too. It's not just the creditor, said Joseph McIntyre, a collection lawyer in New Bedford. But you've got to be brave enough to vindicate your rights. Most people simply settle, he said, and the workflow of the court system is built on that assumption. They'd have a problem if everybody wanted a trial, he said. And I will continue next week with some examples of fighting back. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP, 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.